So settling into body and breath. The Buddha's teaching, or what the Buddha is pointing to, is very, very simple. It's being here with this body, learning the teachings that this body is giving us at every moment. Teachings on change, teachings on interconnectedness, teachings on the dukkha, the suffering of trying to hold on to that which is changing, or of identifying and trying to have agency, or too much agency, over that which is inherently part of nature, not actually who and what we are, not really belonging to us. So the body is going through constant change. Sometimes we like the change, sometimes it's nice, seems good, kind of excited about it. And sometimes it's a little disappointing or scary, also can be. And yet this body, our body, just as every other body that's ever lived, is going through these changes. It's constantly changing, actually. So every time we eat a meal, that meal becomes part of us. It changes the way we are. Every time we listen to something, we're influenced by what we listen to. It influences our mind and sometimes our body as well. What we see, what we surround ourselves with, influences us. So we're influenced by our environment. There's a constant exchange going on between what seems, well, it's not really between, but it seems like, this one here, this separate person over here, that's the unenlightened view, and everything out there, people out there, whether it's an intimate relationship with somebody or a group or just or a culture or just all beings. We influence each other. And then there's the exchange of, well, many things. They have exchange of ideas and of resources and how we do that, whether we're generous or not generous, that's all, and whether we're around people who are friendly or not friendly, this is all part of how we experience ourselves. And then there's the very simple teachings on the elements, for example. But there's earth element externally, there's the earth itself. There's solid things, trees and fruits and tables and houses, all those things, they're all part of the earth element. So this body is part of the earth element, and then the earth itself, obviously, is part of the earth element, and those two are not separate. So the Buddha encourages us to reflect in this way because we feel absolutely separate. We feel absolutely like a separate person, and only I know what's going on here. And it's just different to what is going on for other people, which on some level is really true. So there's a truth in that. We are all very individual characters. We have particular individual karma. We arise individually, uniquely. Every human being arises uniquely as a unique person with particular strengths and weaknesses and idiosyncrasies and leanings. So this is true. And it's also true that we are part of everything. So it's also true that internally there is earth element that's making up this flesh, these bones, these fingernails, this earth element here inside. And there's earth element outside. So I'm sitting on a buckwheat cushion, earth element. I'm sitting on, there's a floor beneath me, earth element. And there's a person sitting next to me who has a fleshy body like mine, earth element. And there's a ceiling on the room I'm in, earth element. And there's the ground on which this house is built that I'm sitting in, earth element. Then I come back here, bones, earth element, teeth, earth element, eyeballs, earth element, flesh, earth element. So we think in that way, and we reflect, not so much thinking, but reflect in that way. And then we recognize earth element internally here, earth element externally, out there. Both are simply earth element. And it's a very interesting exploration. So it's not denying that, that this Ananda Bodhi process here is different to, Bill process going on over there. It's not denying that. It is different. And yet there are many, well, there are many commonalities, but that's not actually the point. But we are all also part of this earth element. That's also a truth. And on that level, we're not getting into the differences and the idiosyncrasies and the unique qualities. So it's not a denying of them, but it's a looking in a different way. And it's looking in a way that supports a deeper understanding of our interconnectedness or our interbeing with everything. And why would we want to know that? Well, there's different reasons. One is when we really understand our interconnectedness with all beings deeply on a visceral level, then we're not caught in, we can't believe in the same way the thoughts of desire and hatred that can arise in relation to each other. There's more equanimity, there's more understanding, and there's more love. There's more true love that's not asking for, give me this, I want that. Be this way, don't be that way. It's when we really understand our interconnectedness or our interbeing, there's less pushing and pulling around. So, in relation to others, there's a deeper sense of kinship, of understanding, of kindness, of compassion, of appreciative joy, and a certain letting go, just understanding that we're all arising in these different ways, subject to causes and conditions. So our conditioning of the past influences how we are in the present. And we can just be caught in that, lost in that, reacting from that, or we can gain a greater understanding of the causes and conditions that are making certain feelings arise now, certain perceptions arise now. And the more understanding we have, the more choice we have in how we respond. Whether we respond in a from compassion and wisdom or from reactivity. So that's one important aspect of understanding our interconnectedness, our interbeing. And another very important aspect is when we reflect on, for example, earth element internally and earth element externally, and earth element both internally and externally. then that sense of separate self gets less real, less acute. So there's sometimes it can be confusing. And the Buddha gives this teaching on not self, which was given to people who had certain understandings in that time in India of atta and anatta, so self and not self, or or atman would be the Sanskrit atman. And then you have in that time and also now, atman with a small a, the self, and atman with a big a, the God or the great self. And so the Buddha is pointing to a different truth. So he's not saying there is or there isn't an Atman with a big A. He's actually not getting into that conversation at all. But he's saying, notice what is not self. So notice how the body belongs to nature and follows the laws of nature. Notice the tendencies of the untrained mind, how it will swing from branch to branch like a monkey, always looking for something nice, something better, something next, something fun, something delicious, something interesting, or maybe swinging away from danger, from something scary, something it's maybe been taunting a tiger and then the tiger's after it and it's like, oh, quick, get away from that. So he recognizes that the Buddha recognizes that the mind is like, can be like a monkey that's always chasing after things, the untrained mind. And then as we train our mind to be our awareness, to be fully present with things as they are, then we start to get glimpses of another way of experiencing. So we start to maybe have little glimpses or sometimes longer experiences of knowing, direct knowing, where for a little while the desire drops and the aversion drops and the stories of who we are and where we're going and what's right and what's wrong in ourselves drops, and there's just this direct experience, spacious, clear, bright awareness. So you might have had moments of that, you might have had longer periods of that, or you may just know of it and know that it's possible. I haven't tasted it yet. But that place of clear knowing, clear presence, that's not pushed and pulled around by the hindrances of the mind is a place of peace. It is a place of abiding. It is a place of joyful presence. And it's available to everybody. It's available here and now to all of us. And yet we miss it because we're looking for something else. We're looking for a temporary pleasure, or we're looking for a permanent pleasure in what is temporary. I think that's the problem. We look for lasting happiness in what is not lasting. We look for a sense of well-being, either by trying to control our environment to be the way we think it should be, so that we feel okay, or by filling ourselves up with nice things, things we buy, things we taste, things we think about, so that we don't have to experience unpleasant feeling tone. So this is the old habit of the human being that we've been doing for goodness knows how long. Humans have been doing, and perhaps we have been doing for a very long time. And then the Buddha sees this. He sees what people are doing. He sees people trying to get what they can, trying to have happiness from what is not lasting, and then being bereft and sad when what they're holding on to changes. Might be a precious relationship, It might be a position in society. It might be a nice building, or even a beautiful and healthy body. And the Buddha sees that we hold on to these things, thinking that they're going to give us lasting happiness, when they can't. They can't give us lasting happiness. They can give us temporary happiness. We can enjoy them for a while, but then they're going to change. And it's just the way of things. And because of that, we fill our attention with, trying to ex experience, trying to get another experience, another good experience, another taste, sound, smell, sight, etc. And then the trouble is that when when we get into this sort of binary way of relating, where we're looking for what is pleasant and we're trying to get away from what is unpleasant, which is the most natural thing to do, we're kind of trapped in this endless cycle of seeking satisfaction in what is inherently unsatisfactory. And so we experience that gratification for a minute or an hour or a day, or maybe even a bit longer, and then it passes. Then we look for something else, and on that goes, or we try and get away from that unpleasant feeling. And often, there's that cycle where it's something feels a bit painful, so we try and find something that's more pleasant, and we fill our mind with what's more pleasant, and that's a relief for a while, but then that ends, and there's that painful thing again. And so it's just this drivenness that keeps us caught in the endless cycle of samsara. And what is samsara? Samsara is the process of birth, aging, and death. When I first heard this framework that the Buddha gave, I was a little confused because it's, well, I've been born. It's kind of too late for that now. And I'm in this process and, it's gonna die at some point. So how do you get out of that? I can't get out of that. I've been born already. And that's true for all of us. We have been born and we have this precious human life. And so he's not pointing to, well, he is actually pointing to the end of birth, but he's pointing to how we take birth moment by moment, again and again. We take birth in seeking pleasure. We take birth in a position of being right or being wrong or being somebody, with a story. We take birth. So each time we, so it can be like we have a story running of, I'm right, for example, the story of I'm right. And that story relies on other people being wrong, because otherwise, how are we going to be right all the time? And so when that thought arises, I'm right. And so that other person's got to be wrong. We've taken birth. We've taken birth as the right person, the person who's right. And in that birth, there's a certain, it feels good for a little while. I am right, actually. I feel strong and I feel clear and I feel confident and it feels good and I'm right. And then what's the effect of that? Yeah, we're right. And if we want to keep that up, we've got to keep asserting it over and over again. We've got to keep controlling our environment, other people. We've got to dominate in order to be right. And it might be that we absolutely believe that we are. And it might even be that we are right. But that's not the point. It took me a long time to realize that there can be many rights, depending on where you're looking from. So you might be right, but that other person with a completely different view might be right too. And so making room for that. And when we don't make room for that, we've just taken birth as a somebody who is right. It feels good, feels great, but it's not aligned with truth. Or at least our attachment to that position is not aligned with truth. So we can be right and have room to make space for other perspectives. And we can be right and have to let go of our position. Sometimes that's essential. And sometimes it's essential to hold our position. You know? So that's where the wisdom and the compassion come in. Because what is the motivation behind this taking a stand of rightness? Is it out of compassion? Is it because there's a deep understanding and wisdom? Or is it just a personal preference that I like being right? Because we all like being right, really. It's a nice feeling. So that's just one way that we can take birth in rightness. And then the inevitability is that that goes through a process of right for a while, then your rightness starts to become wrong at some point, and it starts to be a little bit off, and then we have to let go of that, and we're not right by the end, because you can't sustain any position we take. We can't sustain, because any position we take is a fixed something, and we're trying to fix something in a reality that is ever changing. We might take a position of always being wrong. It's actually, if you're with somebody who's always right, it's sort of a bit of a default position. I'm getting a few laughs here. I think there's some resonance in the room here. I'm familiar with both sides of the coin actually quite well, but yeah. So there's someone who's always wrong. Oh, I must be wrong. Oh, I'm sorry. I must have. Oh, that must be my fault. So nobody is always right, or nobody is always wrong. Sometimes we're right. Sometimes we're wrong. Things change. And what's important is our inner attunement to truth. So if we're deeply attuned to truth, not just the truth of being right, not as you may realize, but this is AI. I didn't do that actually. Okay. Not just the so when I say deeply aligned to truth, I don't mean, obviously, I don't mean holding to a position of being right, but I mean what is actually true right now. And we can kind of feel it in our guts. We actually know, but we often override that knowing to follow an old familiar pattern of being right or being wrong, being the clever one or the foolish one, being the dominant one or the deferring one. We often follow those old patterns, and then we don't quite listen to the inner truth that our gut knows, that our heart knows. And so the more we listen to that, the more we're attuned to the greater truth of the way things are. And part of that is being willing to stand up when it's time for you to stand up, and to bow when it's time for you to bow, or surrender when it's time to surrender. And that's an inner wisdom. It's an inner wisdom that guides that. But in order to hear that wisdom, we have to be willing to give up our personal position in order to make room for this greater truth. And as we do that over gradually over time, or sometimes suddenly, things start to clear out. Things start to clear out of this cluttered experience of being a person. And there gets to be greater clarity, greater wisdom. We actually make room for wisdom and clarity to arise here. And those qualities are not personal. They're not mine. They're not me. But they, there's we clear out the me, the mine, the want, the don't want, to make room for the wisdom and compassion that wants to arise. That is a human potential. It's beautiful. But it means a certain, it involves a certain sacrifice, actually, but a sacrifice of the ego. And it's interesting with this, these different positions we find ourselves in, because of being the dominant one, or the more submissive one, or the one that doesn't want to have anything to do with anybody because it's all too complicated, or whichever it is. Because there's a comfort in that. There's a comfort in taking a position. It feels more safe than opening. And this is why we need to align our lives within an ethical framework, and to keep settling and deepening and looking within until we find greater confidence in the wisdom and compassion that wants to arise through our different instruments, our different ways of being. It takes time. It takes guidance and listening, inner listening, and practice. But over time, we start to recognize that the voice of wisdom is different to the voice of dominance, or the voice of compassion is different to the voice of fear. And that the gut feeling of wisdom, of knowing, is different to a gut feeling of trauma. We get to understand over time the difference. And then as we understand, we can clear out with help. And there's these days so many awesome, amazing, skillful means, therapies and all kinds of different ways that we can start to undo the painful entanglements inside us that then help to undo the complications that happen between ourselves and others. So what the Buddha is pointing to is very simple and immediate and clear. And it's the clutteredness of a person that we've become that gets in the way of seeing that. So part of the path is to refrain from doing harmful things to ourselves and to others that cause greater entanglement and unhappiness. And then to actively do good, to find ways of doing good to benefit others, that creates a foundation, creates the supports for wisdom and compassion to arise. I mean, they actually arise within our good actions, but it supports for a greater knowing and experience and of being wisdom and compassion. And then there's the purifying the mind, purifying the heart. And in our refraining from doing harm, because sometimes we want to do harm, sometimes it comes up in the mind, and or for many people, and in our doing good actively through body, speech, and mind, we are it just in that process. There is a certain purification of mind. We're changing the patterns. We're not following the old habits. We're creating new wholesome habits. And sometimes doing good is also, if somebody does a lot of good for others, sometimes doing good is also like doing a bit less for others and doing some good for yourself. That's important to mention. And then there's the purification of mind through our meditation practice, through sitting and stilling, and through seeing the arising and passing away of things. So through that process of settling and stilling and seeing more clearly, there's a purification of mind. The pushes and the pulls that are so deeply ingrained in us are not being followed in the same way, and so they get weaker. And sometimes strong tendencies that we have, it can be, I know, after longer periods of time of practice, that those strong tendencies we have start to burn up. They don't they don't arise anymore. So this is it's a lifetime's work, not to be in a hurry. The Buddha praised patience above all qualities, because it takes a while, depending on our particular karma, our particular situation. So, we always want to, like, okay, I've got the list, I'm doing all the right things, I want to get the results, And the Buddha is praising patience. It's like, yeah, follow that path, do those, refrain from doing harm, do good, sit there, let the mind go through its purification process, don't be in a hurry, let go. Essentially, we're kind of letting go of the results. And in that letting go, they arise in their own time. Ajahn Chah liked to use the image of a mango tree. It's like you plant the seed, the mango seed, and you water it and you protect it from being eaten by animals, the little seedling as it grows. And then you care for it, you protect it, you water it, you nourish it, but you don't decide when those mangoes are going to be ripe and when you're going to eat them. They're ripe when the tree is ready to produce the mangoes. And even when, it might take years for that tree to be strong enough and well enough and mature enough to produce mangoes. I don't quite know how it works with mangoes, but most fruit trees take a little while. And then finally, when it's ready, it puts out the flowers, and then flowers fade and they start to become the fruits, and then the fruits grow. And then even then, we need to take care that the squirrels don't come and eat those fruits, or that we pick them too soon, and then we eat the mango and it's, oh, green and a bit sour, or maybe you like green mango. Oh. But anyway, in order for it to be ready, we just take care and protect and keep an eye on it, But we don't decide when the fruit is coming, when it's sweet and delicious. But we pay attention, we notice, and we have great patience with our practice. So this is the pointing. This is what the Buddha pointed us to. And it's absolutely 100% worth it. Yep. So in a few minutes, we're going to have our lunch break. And well, it won't be lunch for everybody, actually. There's people on different parts, different time zones. But here, it's a kind of early lunch because we eat early in the morning. And so in this break, we're going to have 2 hours break. It's kind of long. And that's to give you on Zoom a time to be off the computer and to be able to integrate some of these teachings. There's still stillness meditation and walking movement meditation, so you can continue with that around do what you need to do basically. So if you want to eat, then that's to prepare your food and appreciate your food and eat your food and rest if you need to afterwards, or walk. All let that all be part of the practice. It all belongs. Seeing the habits and the tendencies that arise in relation to food, or also in relation to having time. Sometimes it's like, oh, it's really nice to have a guided meditation and you've got this time and the bell's ringing, and it's much easier can be to practice in that way. So it's also interesting to see what happens when you don't have that. So for 2 hours now, there's going to be a more open time, and it's still practice time. It's still for you to bring presence to your experience. to recognize any patterns, any old habits that come up, and to have a chance to see them and meet them in a different way. See what happens if you meet them in a different way. And if you tend towards greed and wanting and trying to get everything quick, then take a breath, let go a little, lean back, slow down. And if you tend towards aversion and you don't want, then take particular care around what you do and really appreciate the moment, really appreciate the breath, really appreciate the shelter that you have right now, really appreciate that there is food if you have something, that there's food or that there's water. So you have to, we have to counter our tendencies so that we see in a more balanced way. And this isn't about becoming a perfect person, but it's about realizing our true potential, which is greater than that. It's greater than being a perfect person. It's being completely part of nature.